taking Paul's lowered head for a nod of agreement. "One good thing among the evils, Usul. I don't like the world we're making, you know that. It was better when we were alone in the desert, with only the Harkonnens for enemy."
"There's but a thin line between many an enemy and many a friend," Bijah said. "Where that line stops, there's no beginning and no end. Let's end it, my friends."
He moved to Paul's side, jittered from one foot to the other. "What's now sense?" Paul asked, dragging out these moments, goading the dwarf.
"Now," Bijah said, trembling. "Now, now."
He tugged at Paul's robe.
"Let us go now."
"His mouth rattles, but there's no harm in him,"
Othame said, affection in his voice, the one good eye staring at Bijah's.
"Even a rattle can signal departure," Bijah said, "and so can tears. Let's be gone while there's time to begin."
"Bijah's, what do you fear?" Paul asked.
"I fear the spirit seeking me now," Bijah's muttered.
Perspiration stood out on his forehead. His cheeks twitched.
"I fear the one who thinks not, and will have no body except mine, and that one gone back into itself. I fear the things I see, and the things I do not see."
This dwarf does possess the power of prescience, Paul thought. Bijah shared the terrifying oracle. Did he share the oracle's fate as well? How potent was the dwarf's power? Did he have the little prescience of those who dabbled in the Dune Tarot? Or was it something greater? How much had he seen?
"Best you go," Duri said. "Bijah's is right." "Every minute we linger," Bijah said, prolongs the present."
"Every minute I linger defers my guilt," Paul thought. A worm's poisonous breath, its teeth dripping dust, had washed over him. It had happened long ago, but he inhaled the memory of it now, spice and bitterness. He could sense his own worm waiting, the urn of the desert. "These are troubled times," he said, addressing himself to Othame's judgment of their world.
"Fremen know what to do in time of trouble," Duri said.
Othame contributed a shaky nod. Paul glanced at Duri. He'd not expected gratitude, would have been burdened by it more than he could bear, but Othame's bitterness and the passionate resentment he saw in Duri's eyes shook his resolve. Was anything worth this price?
"Delay serves no purpose," Duri said.
"Do what you must, Usul," Othame wheezed.
Paul sighed. The words of the vision had been spoken.
"There'll be an accounting," he said, to complete it.
Turning, he strode from the room, heard Bijah's foot slapping behind.
"Bygones, bygones," Bijah's muttered as they went. "Let bygones fall where they may. This has been a dirty day."
The convoluted wording of legalisms grew up around the necessity to hide from ourselves the violence we intend toward each other. Between depriving a man of 1 hour from his life and depriving him of his life, there exists only a difference of degree. You have done violence to him, consumed his energy. Elaborate euphemisms may conceal your intent to kill, but behind any use of power over another, the ultimate assumption remains: I feed on your energy. Addenda to Orders in Council, the Emperor Paul Muad'Dib. First moon stood high over the city as Paul, his shield activated and shimmering around him, emerged from the cul-de-sac. A wind off the massif whirled sand and dust down the narrow street, causing Bijah's to blink and shield his eyes.
"We must hurry," the dwarf muttered. "Hurry, hurry!"
"You sense danger?" Paul asked, probing.
"I know danger."
An abrupt sense of peril very near was followed almost immediately by a figure joining them out of a doorway. Bijah's crouched and whimpered. It was only Stilgar moving like a war machine, head thrust forward, feet striking the street solidly. Swiftly, Paul explained the value of the dwarf, handed Bijah's over to Stilgar. The pace of the vision moved here with great rapidity. Stilgar sped away with Bijah's. Security guards enveloped Paul. Orders were given to send men down the street toward the house beyond Othame's. The men hurried to obey, shadows among shadows. More sacrifices, Paul thought.
"We want live prisoners," one of the guard officers hissed.
The sound was a vision echo in Paul's ears. It went with solid precision here. Vision reality, tick for tick. Ornithopters drifted down across the moon. The night was full of Imperial troopers attacking. A soft hiss grew out of the other sounds, climbed to a roar while they still heard the sibilance. it picked up a terracotta glow that hid the stars, engulfed the moon. Paul, knowing that sound and glow from the earliest nightmare glimpses of his vision, felt an odd sense of fulfillment. It went the way it must.
"Stoneburner!"
someone screamed.
"Stoneburner!"
The cry was all around him.
"Stoneburner! Stoneburner!"
Because it was required of him, Paul threw a protective arm across his face, dove for the low lip of a curb. It already was too late, of course. Where Othame's house had been, there stood now a pillar of fire, a blinding jet roaring at the heavens. It gave off a dirty brilliance which threw into sharp relief every ballet movement of the fighting and fleeing men, the tipping retreat of ornithopters. For every member of this frantic throng, it was too late. The ground grew hot beneath Paul. He heard the sound of running stop. Men threw themselves down all around him, every one of them aware that there was no point in running. The first damage had been done, and now they must wait out the extent of the stone burner's potency. The thing's radiation, which no man could outrun, already had penetrated their flesh. The peculiar result of stone burner radiation already was at work in them. What else this weapon might do now lay in the planning of the men who had used it, the men who had defied the great convention to use it.
"Gods, a stone burner!"
someone whimpered.
"I don't want to be blind."
"Who does?"
The harsh voice of a trooper far down the street.
"The Tlaelaxu will sell many eyes here," someone near Paul growled. "Now shut up and wait."
They waited. Paul remained silent, thinking what this weapon implied. Too much fuel in it, and it had cut its way into the planet's core. Dune's molten level lay deep, but the more dangerous for that. Such pressures released and out of control might split a planet, scattering lifeless bits and pieces through space.
"I think it's dying down a bit," someone said. "It's just digging deeper," Paul cautioned. "Stay put, all of you. Stilgar will be sending help."
"Stilgar got away?"
"Stilgar got away."
"The ground's hot,"
someone complained.
"They dared use atomics," a trooper near Paul protested.
"The sound's diminishing," someone down the street said.
Paul ignored the words, concentrated on his fingertips against the street. He could feel the rolling rumbling of the thing. Deep, deep.
"My eyes!" someone cried. "I can't see!"
Someone closer to it than I was, Paul thought. He still could see to the end of the cul-de-sac when he lifted his head, although there was a mistiness across the scene. A red-yellow glow filled the area where Othame's house and its neighbor had been. Pieces of adjoining buildings made dark patterns as they crumbled into the glowing pit. Paul climbed to his feet. He felt the stone burner die, silenced beneath him. His body was wet with perspiration against the still suit's slickness, too much for the suit to accommodate. The air he drew into his lungs carried the heat and sulfur stench of the burner. As he looked at the troopers beginning to stand up around him, the mist on Paul's eyes faded into darkness. He summoned up his oracular vision of these moments then, turned and strode along the track that time had carved for him, fitting himself into the vision so tightly that it could not escape. He felt himself grow aware of this place as a multitudinous possession, reality welded to prediction. Moans and groans of his troopers arose all around him as the men realized their blindness.
"Hold fast!" Paul shouted. "Help is coming!"
And as the complaints persisted, he said,
"This is Muad'Dib. I command you to hold fast. Help comes!"
Silence. Then, true to his vision, a nearby guardsman said,
"Is it truly the Emperor? Which of you can see? Tell me."
"None of us has eyes," Paul said. "They have taken my eyes as well, but not my vision. I can see you standing there, a dirty wall within touching distance on your left. Now wait bravely. Stilgar comes with our friends."
The thwack-thwack of many thopters grew louder all around. There was the sound of hurrying feet. Paul watched his friends come, matching their sounds to his oracular vision.
"Stilgar!" Paul shouted, waving an arm. "Over here!"
"Thanks to Shai-Hulud," Stilgar cried, running up to Paul. "You're not..."
In the sudden silence, Paul's vision showed him Stilgar staring with an expression of agony at the ruined eyes of his friend and emperor.
"Oh, my lord," Stilgar groaned. "Usul! Usul! Usul!"
"What of the stone burner?"
one of the newcomers shouted.
"It's ended," Paul said, raising his voice. He gestured. "Get up there now and rescue the ones who are closest to it. Put up barriers. Lively now!"
He turned back to Stilgar.
"Do you see, my lord?" Stilgar asked, wonder in his tone. "How can you see?"
For answer, Paul put a finger out to touch Stilgar's cheek above the stillsuit mouth cap, felt tears.
"You need give no moisture to me, old friend," Paul said. "I am not dead."
"But your eyes?"
"They've blinded my body, but not my vision," Paul said. "Ah, Still, I live in an apocalyptic dream. My steps fit into it so precisely that I fear most of all I will grow bored reliving the things so exactly."
"Ursul, I don't...
"Don't try to understand it. Accept it. I am in the world beyond this world here. For me, they are the same. I need no hand to guide me. I see every movement all around me. I see every expression of your face. I have no eyes, yet I see."
Stilgar shook his head sharply.
"Sired, we must conceal your affliction from..."
"We hide it from no man," Paul said.
"But the law..."
"We live by the Atreides law now, Still. The Fremen law, that the blind should be abandoned in the desert, applies only to the blind. I am not blind. I live in the cycle of being, where the war of good and evil has its arena. We are at a turning point in the succession of ages, and we have our parts to play."
In a sudden stillness, Paul heard one of the wounded being led past him.
"It was terrible," the man groaned. "A great fury of fire."
"None of these men shall be taken into the desert," Paul said. "You hear me, Still?"
"I hear you, my lord."
"They are to be fitted with new eyes at my expense."
"It will be done, my lord."
Paul, hearing the awe grow in Stilgar's voice, said,
"I will be at the command, Thopter. Take charge here."
"Yes, my lord."
Paul stepped around Stilgar, strode down the street. His vision told him every movement, every irregularity beneath his feet, every face he encountered. He gave orders as he moved, pointing to men of his personal entourage, calling out names, summoning to himself the ones who represented the intimate apparatus of government. He could feel the terror grow behind him, the fearful whispers.
"His eyes!
But he looked right at you, called you by name!" At the command thopter, he deactivated his personal shield, reached into the machine and took the microphone from the hand of a startled communications officer, issued a swift string of orders, thrust the microphone back into the officer's hand. Turning, Paul summoned a weapons specialist, one of the eager and brilliant new breed, who remembered siege life only dimly.
"They used a stone burner," Paul said.
After the briefest pause, the man said,
"So I was told, sire."
"You know what that means, of course."
"The fuel could only have been atomic."
Paul nodded, thinking of how this man's mind must be racing. Atomics. The Great Convention prohibited such weapons. Discovery of the perpetrator would bring down the combined retributive assault of the great houses. Old feuds would be forgotten, discarded in the face of this threat, and the ancient fears it aroused.
"It cannot have been manufactured without leaving some traces," Paul said. "You will assemble the proper equipment and search out the place where the stone burner was made."
"At once, sire."
With one last fearful glance, the man sped away.
"My lord," the communications officer ventured from behind him, "your eyes..."
Paul turned, reached into the thopter, returned the command set to his personal band.
"Call Chani," he ordered. Tell her I am alive and will be with her soon."
Now the forces gather, Paul thought, and he noted how strong was the smell of fear in the perspiration all around.
"He has gone from Alia, the womb of heaven. Holy, holy, holy. Fire sand leagues confront our lord. He can see without eyes. A demon upon him. Holy, holy, holy equation. He solved for martyrdom."
The moon falls down. Songs of Muad'Dib. After 7 days of radiating fevered activity, the keep took on an unnatural quiet. On this morning there were people about, but they spoke in whispers, heads close together, and they walked softly. Some scurried with an oddly furtive gait. The sight of a guard detail coming in from the forecourt drew questioning looks and frowns at the noise which the newcomers brought, with their tramping about and stacking of weapons. The newcomers caught the mood of the interior, though, and began moving in that furtive way. Talk of the stone burner still floated around.
"He said the fire had blue green in it, and a smell out of hell."
"Elpa is a fool. He says he'll commit suicide rather than take Tlealaxu eyes."
"I don't like talk of eyes. Muad'Dib passed me and called me by name."
How does he see without eyes?
People are leaving. Had you heard?